This podcast edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 16th of January 2012. Culture, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 14th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we'll be scrutinising and evaluating ourselves as we debate the role of the critic. In an age of bloggerisation and user reviews, do we still need these eloquent powers that be to tell us what to do? Joining me at Midori House in our studios are Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, Alex Godfrey and Andrew Mueller, both of whom have peppered the pages of almost every worthwhile periodical, writing about gigs, records, films and the media. Writers whose ink matters, the three of them.
You don't get the same kind of excitable criticism anymore, which on the one hand would say that Record X is worth going out without food for a week to own, while anybody who buys Record Y should be, you know, nailed to a tree and pelted with vegetables.
We'll also be staying ahead of the game as we visit the Eurosonic Music Festival in the Netherlands to work out which European bands will be the ones to watch on the summer festival circuit.
It's the only one which has an only European showcase. I hope Daughter does well. Theme Park, I think, are really good. Spectre are really good. Tribes, and they're just the kind of, you know, the British guitar band.
And we'll be chatting to the CEO of Tivoli Audio, Tom DeVesto, to hear more about his company's combination of quality design and thoughtful knob twiddling.
You had a convincing sound and had a very small, easy-to-use package. So the design and the performance became sort of so intertwined that I don't really know how to give, you know, more credence to the design or the performance. I think it's both very important.
All that, plus we'll hear what people are reading in Miami, spin tracks from our album of the week, and enjoy 60 seconds of sound from the streets of Mexico. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Hope you enjoy it. Well, seeing as we're talking critics, I'm going to offer a bit of critical perspective right now with our album of the week. We Have Band are a London-based trio that have just delivered their second album, Turnion, that's both a shower and a grower and a significant step on from their first outing. It's slinky, groovy thing that's not afraid to stroke its beard broodingly too. We'll be playing a couple of tracks from the album, and here's the first. This is What's Mine, What's Yours.
Don't you ever ask me what's mine.
And that was What's Mine and What's Yours from my album of the week, Turnion, by We Have Band. Now, some people love them, some people don't, and an increasing number of people think they are them. And we're not talking about politicians, we're talking about critics. Offering us their insights and opinions from restaurants to new records, films to literary festivals, these figures were once considered the go-to characters and one wanted to find out what was worth doing. So how does this still stand? Joining me in the studio are Alex Godfrey, Andrew Mueller and Matt Wolfe, a triple bill of critical minds to offer their insights on their own profession. So first up, we should probably ask you what you critics thought of that song. Andrew?
Me, I thought it was okay-ish. It reminded me a bit of Okkervil River, but without the sort of slightly country-ish edges or sort of exuberant wit.
Alex and Matt, maybe you could give us a word to sum up what you thought of it.
Harmless. Pleasant.
Oh, okay. All right. So exactly. We can all agree that we did slightly disagree on that, possibly on that record. How important is it for critics to agree with each other? Do you ever feel the need to look up what other people say about things after you've written a review of something? Matt, for example, about Theatre, the theatre critic of the International Herald Tribune. It's an august newspaper. Yeah. And there's obviously you have to take what you do very seriously because you've got a responsibility to your readers as well as to the thing that you're writing about.
It can be very scary being the lone voice about something, particularly if you're the lone voice of negation. And I think a lot of critics are terrified of that and, if anything, err on the side of being positive because it's easier to like something. Nobody's going to be mad at you for liking something, but it's not necessarily the best position to be in to dislike it if you're the only one. On the other hand, there have been a lot of great critics across disciplines. I mean, the wonderful late Pauline Kael of The New Yorker, who made a career out of being, you know, famously churlish about movies that everyone else loved. So, you know, if you've got the talent and the voice to back it up, fine.
So it's easier to like something than it is to not. I suppose you're not going to offend any artists, any directors, or any PRs that way, Andrew. How is it important, you know, if you're a critic though, to find your voice for your readers as well and make sure you sort of stay in employment and are interesting and amusing to read?
I think all you can do being a critic, and especially a music critic, which is what I've done a fair bit of, is actually just be honest with yourself and be straightforward with your readers. There is nothing duller than a critical consensus. There's even something to be said, attention-seeking though it can be, just to being contrary for the sake of it. That doesn't happen very often now in music magazines anymore. The British Music Press especially used to pride itself on a tradition of taking sacred cows to the slaughter, but that has been rather, and I think unfortunately, abandoned in recent years. But I think it's just the only way that you will attract a regular readership is for people to kind of tune into your idiosyncrasies, whether they agree with them or disagree with them violently. But, you know, people still keep coming back, will still keep coming back to you if you display some sort of independent thought.
And Alex, you've reviewed and been a critic for lots of different publications. Do you find that it may be harder to have an independent voice? Do you have to tune it to each individual publication that you're writing for? Do you sometimes perhaps change the volatility of your views depending upon the pages that they're going to appear between?
It depends what they allow you to do and what you can get away with. I think it's not about telling the readers or the listeners what they should like or dislike.
Yeah.
I think for me, criticism is about starting a discussion, starting a debate, not telling people to go in a certain direction. As long as you're confident in your opinion and you've got the knowledge to back it up and you say something perceptive and say something, and you know, I'd love people to disagree with me.
One of the things we wanted to kick off talking about was the role of the critic in the changing media landscape. I mean, Andrew, do you feel that, I mean, you've got a blog, you're a presenter on Monocle 24, you obviously have done, you know, years and years of music criticism, and people, you know, people follow you on Twitter and all the rest of it because they know your name and they know your byline. Do you feel that the way that you work has changed a lot? Do you write about more? Are more people aware of your view on this record or this place or your writings on you know, foreign affairs and travelling to dangerous places? I mean, do you think it's changed simply because of the ways that people can access your writing?
It's made it easier for someone like me to broadcast, you know, what they do, and so and to have a kind of one-stop place where everybody who, you know, and I can't begin to imagine there's that many of those people, but somebody who's absolutely riveted by every single thing I write, it's very easy, it's much easier for them now to find all that aggregated in one place than it used to be when they would have had to go out and buy a variety of publications. It's changed the relationship with readers to an extent in that it's much easier now for people to get in touch with you or pass comment on what you've done than it used to be, say, when I worked for Melody Maker in the early to mid-90s, when people actually had to do the whole kind of writing a letter, buying a stamp and walking to the post office thing. Whether or not that's actually changed what I write and the way I write it, not really. What has changed about the way I write about music is that it is increasingly difficult to express, at least for a paying publication, the kind of slightly either passionate or vituperative opinions we regularly used to trade in at Melody Maker. You don't get the same kind of excitable criticism anymore, which on the one hand would say that record X is worth going out without food for a week to own, while anybody who buys record Y should be, you know, nailed to a tree and pelted with vegetables. You can't really write like that about music anymore, which I think is a shame, because I do.
Why is that? Why?
Well, because magazines won't print it, because they're frightened of upsetting the advertisers and readers they still have. And the reality was that certainly for Melody Maker and I guess NME, as recently as the mid-90s, we could offend our readers and advertisers all we liked because there wasn't anywhere else for them to go. And now there is. So I think a certain timidity has crept into a lot of music magazines now, which I think is a shame, and I think is actually counterproductive.
Maybe it's a job of changing significance. Maybe it's not. But how responsible do you feel to the title to which you're writing and to your audience? Matt, going to the theatre is quite an investment for people. Tickets are £50 normally for a decent seat in the stalls. So you presumably have a lot of responsibility to your readers.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you got a huge responsibility to your readership? I mean, you know, the cost of going to a Broadway show now is several hundred dollars, and it's creeping up to that on the West End, although it's not as bad here as it is in America. And you're certainly not reviewing the play because you're worried what James Corden is going to think or what Robert Lindsay and Jonah Lumley are going to think. That if you go down that route, that way madness lies, you know, you might as well just be a PR adjunct. And there are strands of criticism across all disciplines which are just becoming PR under a different name. And I think you really have to remember that it is a relationship with your reader and, as Andrew suggests, a relationship with yourself. I mean, essentially, you're being honest to yourself and then you're disseminating that across your readership.
And PR by a different adjunct is an interesting way of looking at some of the things that pop up on, you know, a lot of stuff that appears on websites. It's kind of difficult to know with what sort of critical acumen it was written. Do you find that there is a mixing, Alex? Because I know you work across the web a lot as well.
Some of the quotes that these film companies are using on their posters now are just ridiculous.
And the places they come from as well.
The places they come from. I mean, even they're taking them from. Sometimes there's this film website, Ain't It Cool News? Do you know that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough to use it from there. If you're happy with that, if you think that your demographic is gonna respond to that, but I think it's legitimate to use it from something like that if you're using it from one of the head writers there and you give his name. But sometimes they just write, you know, this is the best film I've ever seen. Ain't It Cool News? That could come from anyone who's written anything in the 500 comments under whatever, and it bothers me that there will be people out there who will take that as read and not know that and think, well, that's an authoritative source and they say it's good.
Yeah, well,
it could come from anyone.
And presumably for some of these things, as I say, for the less popular end of things, that it's not everybody having to trot out a review for the new Coldplay or Madonna film or whatever it is. There is a sense that a critic is adding to the canon of words about a particular art form rather than simply, you know, being a hit counter on a website. I suppose that's the thing, having to take yourself seriously, that you are actually, if you're presumably criticising a classical music record, it's given sort of a different shrift to whether you're writing a 50-word review of a Coldplay album as well. I mean, it's a different idea, isn't it?
What has afflicted rock journalism, I think, is it's that same contraction to the centre, that kind of like very, very cosy consensus which is gathered around everything. So the whole field of rock criticism has turned into this slightly staid exercise in box-ticking consumerism where basically pretty much every review you now read of pretty much every record essentially says the kind of people who like this sort of thing will find this to be the sort of thing that they like.
Right, yeah.
There's very little attempt to engage or, heaven forfend, provoke the readers. And really, you know, I think there is still a place for that, because a great piece of criticism about anything, whether it's a record or a play or a film, can add to your understanding of it. It can complement the artwork. It can exist as a separate thing alongside it. It can be a good thing in its own right. There is, I think, there's always been this slightly timid attitude that because you're writing something about something else, that what you're doing is by definition inferior. And I don't think that's the case, because, you know, because all plays and rock records and films are themselves all about some other thing entirely. I think you can add something to it. You can deepen people's understanding of the good things or indeed the bad things about the thing you're writing about. And I think that opportunity is being passed up quite a lot now.
And I mean, I wonder what you can say about the importance of criticism to the general public. I mean, there was the age, it kind of has fizzled out a bit, but for movies, when they're advertising movies on the TV, there'd be testimonial advertising where people would be walking, they'd show people having walked out of the cinema going, well, I loved Lord of the Rings, it was absolutely brilliant, it was so exciting, and Gollum's really weird and scary, it's brilliant, definitely go and see it again. And that was sort of, that was almost as bad as someone on Amazon sort of saying, well, I bought War and Peace and it was really massive and boring.
I think it's worse. Do you know what I mean? How can you trust them? How can you trust those things?
Yeah.
But I also think, maybe it's a bit of a nasty thing to say, but I think anyone who doesn't think for themselves and says they liked it, I must go and see it because they say it's good. You know, you read around, get a sense of what you're going to like or what you're going to be into and go and see it. I mean, there's no critic in the world who should tell you what to think.
It would be good to go around the table and ask you guys about what things you were proud to have sort of tipped correctly, in inverted commas, or what turned out to be a Stone Cold classic, and some of the things that maybe you were excited about at the time and haven't perhaps stood the test of time. Andrew, you're making a face that you have a sort of slightly rueful face, possibly over there.
I've never been all that thrilled by the clairvoyant role of the rock critic's job.
Yes.
I've always had a very lackadaisical approach to sort of tipping what was going to be big next year. But I've always been happy, I have to say, when I occasionally will get an email from somebody who has followed one of my particular hobby horses and gone and found the records and written to me to say they really enjoyed them, thinking particularly of an Australian group called the Go-Betweens, who made some fabulous but much underrated records in the 80s. And a current British songwriter called Cathal Coughlan, previously of Micro Disney and the Fatima Mansions, both of whom are artists I've banged on and on about interminably whenever I've had the opportunity. And it's really nice. That makes me feel like, okay, that was worthwhile.
Alex, is it one of those things where you've had the feeling where you've loved something wholeheartedly, and you'd have written about it in your diary or told your friends about it down the pub to the nth degree, and then when you write about it in a publication, they actually get a bit of the limelight shone on them. You get a greater sense of satisfaction out of that than you would out of any paycheck you got for writing about them.
Yeah, it's one of the great things about the job, to be able to give support to something that you love and you want other people to see that might not necessarily get it. I mean, all the big studio-funded films are going to get seen.
Yeah.
Anyway, because the marketing hammers people into submission. But, you know, some things on the lower rung, it's great to be able to get it out there. There was a film last year by Kevin Smith, who's been making films for years and years and years. A couple of them have been great. Most of them have been pretty abysmal. And he made this film himself. It was independently funded. It was called Red State. I loved it. It wasn't going to get a massive distribution. It didn't have a massive marketing budget, but I loved it. I did a piece on it, and I know some of my friends went to see it on the back of it, not because it was me, but because they read it and said that we didn't know about that. It's interesting. It's great for people to read something that you've written that they haven't read about. And I know also from the feedback after that article on the site that people said they were going to go and see it, and it does make you feel like you've actually contributed something to something you like, which is great. It's good to spread the love.
Spread the love. Well, thank you all, gentlemen, very much for joining me. Thank you for joining us at Critics Circle here on The Culture Show. That was Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the AHT, Andrew Mueller, rock critic for All and Sundry, including Monocle 24, and Alex Godfrey for The Guardian and loads of other people. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde. I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Monocle's weekly culture show with me, Robert Bound, where every week we like to ask the independent business owners in your neighbourhood to give us some recommendations for what to read, listen to and watch. This week we're off to Miami, where Alistair G dropped in recently at Books and Books to get some recommendations.
I'm Mitchell Kaplan, the owner of Books and Books in South Florida. We are standing now in our Carl Gables store. We have two other stores as well in South Florida, one on Lincoln Road and one in the Bal Harbour Shops. This is our kind of flagship store in Coral Gables. It's a beautiful store built around a courtyard in an old Mediterranean-style building, which is on the historic register as well. And when you walk into our store, the first thing you see is basically kind of like a newsstand in a courtyard. And this helps draw people in from the sidewalks. And then we have a bar. We have a beer and wine license. At night we have music. And we have a full-blown cafe that also operates out of our courtyard. But then when you walk into the store, if you come in on the west side, you're greeted with what we call the new and notable room. This is where we have the indie-bound bestsellers. Indie-bound is a program of the American Booksellers Association, where over 2,000 independent bookstores come together and give their bestsellers. And some of the bestsellers on the list, which are probably a little different than the traditional bestsellers. And so on this list, you see, for instance, Joan Didion's Blue Nights very high up on the list. You also see Murakami's new novel very high up on the list. The other thing you have when you walk into the store, two books that we've published here at Books and Books that are kind of cool. One is called Blue Christmas. The subtitle is Holiday Stories for the Rest of Us. They're non-sentimental, dark short stories, original short stories, written by very well-known authors like Robert Gulrich, Anne Hood, Jane Hamilton, Steve Almond. And this is one of two books that we at Books and Books have published. And then as you walk in, you can see that in our windows, being that this is holiday time, we have gift books that are particular to South Florida. We have two marvelous books on Cuba and Havana. One is called The Splendor of Cuba, which is a tremendous, beautiful book on Cuban architecture. The other is The Great Houses of Havana, which is just that. It's all of the great, large, beautiful houses. We also have a history of Def Jam Recordings, which was put together by two of the founders, two of the early employees of Def Jam. These books happen to be signed. For the holiday season, we bring out all the books that people had signed who had come, because we think those make really kind of interesting gifts as well. We have each year about 600 to 700 author events in the store, things like readings and demonstrations. Just recently, we had the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal was here. 2 days before that, we had Bill Clinton. So we have a pretty interesting group of people who come to the store.
Thank you very much, Alistair G. What a lovely little audio treat. Still to come in part two of Culture with me, Robert Bound, we'll hear what the CEO of Tivoli Audio has to say about where his company is headed. We'll make sure we're bang on trend with what to expect from this summer's festival lineups at Eurosonic Festival in the Netherlands and enjoy some wacky audio offerings from the streets of Mexico City. Stay tuned. But before all that, time for some more music. Here's a lovely little song from someone we're hoping to get in for a session this spring. It's Hello Darling with Dreaming. That was Dreaming by Hello Darling. You're listening to The Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. Now here at Monocle, we love a good media story, and we also love radio. In fact, if you'd like to hear a great show, try edition 9 of Culture, where we dedicated a whole damn programme to it. How meta. Tivoli Audio have been making high-end, well-designed hi-fi kits since 2000. Their handsome wood separates have become ubiquitous in the listening rooms of the cool. Recently, Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove sat down with Tom DeVesto, CEO of Tivoli Audio, to find out more about his audio dreams.
So Tom, I wanted to start by asking you about sort of the evolution of design at Tivoli and sort of where you've come from and, you know, how these radios, and we have one here, have sort of changed over the last couple of years.
Well, first of all, I've made a radio in several companies that I've owned over the years. In addition to other products, early days of a company called Advent, we made the first large screen televisions, first cassette decks for audio for music use. And we made a radio that was rather simple to use, very high quality, not too expensive. And most of that product was made, you know, in the traditional hi-fi sense. They were either black or silver sort of things with wooden boxes. And when it came to starting Tivoli to make only radios, the very first product we made called the Model 1, tried to decide, you know, what color, what form factor should it take? And we ended up something very sort of Bauhaus, you know. It ends up looking like what it needs to look like to function well. But we wanted to take it another step, and so we decided to make prototypes in a number of different wood finishes and different colored faceplates and things. And the intent there was to pick one of them and go to market with it. Well, after we'd made about a dozen prototypes, there were four or five of them that we really liked, different colors, different wood textures and wood finishes. And so we decided to bring out in the beginning four different colored units with blues and grays, pastels. It really started off a new trend for us, and I think in some ways changed a lot of the business from some of our competitors and partners, this idea of bringing color into the home. And then so for me, it became as important to make the product something that was beautiful and that you'd want to keep in your house, an accessory, if you will, to your home furnishings, as well as something that was high performance and sounded the way it should, so that whether you were listening to symphony or rock and roll, you had a convincing sound and had a very small, easy-to-use package. So the design and the performance became sort of so intertwined that I don't really know how to give, you know, more credence to the design or the performance. I think it's both very important.
And we've seen sort of the fortunes of radio itself sort of changing, shifting. I wondered, you know, now we've seen this sort of revival, really, and whether, and as you said, these radios are sort of coveted items. Has that changed your sort of strategy or business strategy? And have you started making these products that are just really sort of coveted items?
Yeah, when we first started Tivoli, I guess it's been almost 14 years now, people really asked me, you know, why do I want to make a radio? This was a day when the internet was starting to show some real promise. Digital content was becoming rather overwhelming. CDs were looked at as a temporary, at best, form of delivering the content. Radio really had reached a point of being delegated to some almost prehistoric way of delivering content and entertainment to people. And the truth is, it's probably still one of the most widely used medium for delivering content. I think it will stay that way for a long time, although the technology will change. It's unlikely that analog radio signals will exist, you know, many decades from now. The economics of being able to digitize signals and in the bandwidth of a normal FM station send out two or three or four radio stations, and the economy dictates that that's the way that's going to go. But you mentioned internet radio. We came out with our first product, I guess it's been 5 years now, called Networks. The content available on the internet, there's, you know, depending on whose count and the quality of the stations you want to include, but between 12 and 20,000 stations available worldwide that one can get really from about anywhere in the world that they have a internet connection or a Wi-Fi connection. It also allows a radio station to be, could be a small room in someone's house. If they have content that people want to hear, they can compete with the biggest stations around because it doesn't require a big transmitter and a lot of power and licenses and all the rest of that. So it really opens up the field to allow things that just couldn't exist in the old style. But in particular, radio, as I think of radio, you know, it's a device you turn on, someone starts talking to you, maybe playing music for you, delivering sports or news. There's a serendipity there that's not available in any of the other content delivery forms. You might have 10,000 iTunes on your computer or your iPhone, but picking one of them at any given moment is not quite the same as just being listening to the radio and having something come on that goes, you might have it in your iTunes, but maybe you'd have never selected it at that moment. And you go, wow, that really hits me, reminds me of an old girlfriend or a place I was. So radio delivers a serendipity unavailable from any of the other content delivery forms.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of prediction there. And do you think that you're going to see more and more competitors coming to the market when they see, you know, the kind of promise that radio presents?
I think so. I mean, there are still economic barriers. The bandwidth is getting to be more coveted, and I think will probably increase in price. You know, so back to my comment about anyone can start a radio station. That's true today. It's going to become more difficult as content goes up in price. But I do think you're going to see some nice fresh ideas brought into the media. You know, I give talks every now and then, large groups of people, and one of the questions that inevitably comes up is, you know, who's your customer? Who do you make your radios for?
And I was going to ask, who is your market?
Well, I mean, I have a sort of a wisecrack answer, and that's people who like to listen to the radio. And when I say that in a group, I can tell by the faces out there, those people know who I mean. They go home from work, they turn on the radio while they're preparing dinner, or they sit around in the evening if they have a few spare hours and have a glass of wine and listen to the radio. So it's really people who are already attracted to the medium and really maybe in some cases almost addicted to it that we try to make products for.
That was Tom DeVesto, CEO of Tivoli Audio, talking to our Sophie Grove. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Eurosonic Festival after this.
Avant-garde. Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, if you're a festival booking agent or an up-and-coming band, and you know what's good for you, you'll probably have been at Eurosonic Festival this last weekend. It's the biggest festival for the European music industry and takes place in Groningen in the Netherlands. It kicks off the whole year for musicians and agents, and festival representatives from all over the world attend to check out the most up-and-coming European acts, and the best of those generally end up filling the festival timetables later on in the year. Marcellus was there for us.
I'm in a small northern Dutch student town. There's cyclists everywhere, drunk young people pouring out of bars, chips and kebab wrappers on the ground, and 3,000 European music industry representatives running from venue to venue. It's Eurosonic, and it's the 26th year of this festival. I spoke with festival founder Peter Schmidt to get the full details of the festival.
My name is Peter Schmidt. I'm founder and creative director of Eurosonic Noorderslag. Eurosonic is a conference for music professionals. We have about 3,000 professionals from the European music business here, and a showcase festival for European music. We would like to have a better circulation of European music in Europe, and that's why we organize the event. So we try to bring the best of new talent together in showcases in the evenings. And during the day, we discuss a lot of issues in the music sector. Yeah, we are a festival about discovery. Most of the bands that we put on are unknown bands. People don't know the bands before they play Eurosonic. Some of the bands, of course, are very well known in their own country, but not abroad. And if all goes well, then after the event, the band is more known and has a career outside their own borders.
Eurosonic's really important for booking agents and festival representatives. Here's Emma Hogan from London to explain why.
Hey, I'm Emma. I work at ITB in London as a booking agent. I'm here mostly to meet people this year. Usually I have a couple of bands I already work with playing. It's not the case this year, which actually I thought I might feel a little bit useless, but it's actually made me feel quite free and that I don't have to be chasing people and worrying about who's coming to my show and who's not. So this year for me, it's more about meetings, really trying to find people, pin people down and just sort of spend 10 or 15 minutes chatting with people and figure out what we're going to do this year with bands we work on together. I haven't missed a year, with this one being the fifth. It's incredibly important. I mean, if you look around, if you look at the delegate list as well, and if you look at pretty much every show, pretty much every European festival booker, every European promoter, most of the European agents are all here, and everybody's brought their best new bands or at least the ones that they're ready to present to the rest of the European market. And it's just, I mean, everybody being in the same place at the same time is awesome. Eurosonic are really picky about the bands that they let play. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps as well, because you know you're going to see a load of quality artists. The best band that I saw last night were a Spanish band called The Suicide of Western Culture. If you get the chance to go and see them, go and see them. It sounds really euphoric, but then they're projecting all these videos that are really bleak, and I like that.
I'm Hugh Stevens, and I'm a DJ on BBC Radio 1. And I've been coming for about 5 years with Radio 1, and we've brought some bands with us every year, like Everything Everything, and Pete and the Pirates, and Das Wunderlust, and it's a really good way of seeing lots of bands. It's a really good kind of snapshot of what's happening in Europe. It's the only one which has an only European showcase. You've got none of them American bands interfering with stuff. I hope Daughter does well. From the bands playing here, Theme Park, I think, are really good. The Spectre are really good. Tribes, and they're just the kind of, you know, the British guitar bands.
I'm Victor, I'm a drummer of the band Who's the Racket. Apparently, it's a great festival for the newcomer who want to have a little place in Northern Europe. And, you know, for all the promoters and stuff, we can see you here, and it's like a big showcase, and it's good to be here. I think for here, we are quite new. You know, in France, we're huge, but we play in stadium and everything, but...
Chosen Groningen, because I lived in Groningen, so you start organizing event usually in the place where you live. But Groningen is the perfect place, in fact, to organize an event like this, because I don't think there's many cities with so many live music venues in a very small distance from each other with different capacities. The building where we hold the conference and Noorderslag is also very suitable for an event like this. So basically the event is more or less also built on the city, and we have the luxury of, like I said, having a lot of suitable venues. And although we use quite a lot of venues at the moment, about 27, there's still more venues, if we would like, that we can use. So this town is perfect. Another advantage is that in Groningen there's no closing time for bars and clubs, so you can go on as long as you want. And I think that's a pretty good advantage as well.
Eurosonic is the perfect way to kick off the music year, and everyone is looking forward to a successful and bright 2012. But can anyone actually pronounce the city we're in?
Groningen.
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 I know I'm still struggling myself, but for Monocle in Groningen, I'm Mar Sellers.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Pound. It's Monocle 24. It's time for the return in 2012 of one of our favourite features. Yes, you guessed it, it's the creatively titled and life-affirmingly heartwarming nugget of joy that is Book Corner, a chance for people to share some of the writing they love with the rest of us. This week, our producer Katie Bilboa took time out of her busy schedule and she chose to read something she just found fascinating from The Idler, her new favourite magazine. This is an abridged version of Robert Ringham's essay From Business Plan to Escape Plan, How Cottage Industry Can Save You from Servitude.
Like a Roman slave, it's possible to buy one's freedom. You want to flee a life of white-collar servitude? Fortunately, being paid to sit in front of a computer is a healthy circumstance from which to start plotting your escape. It's from here that you might begin. 1. Ensure you're paid at least £355 per week. To settle for less is to squander yourself. If you must sell a portion of your youth for money, make sure it's at the going rate. 2. Save money. You will need moderately healthy financial reserves to fund the first weeks or months of your escape. Aim to save a useful sum. I recommend at least £5,000, though the more you save, the more comfortable you can be for a while. This sum is your escape fund. 3. Use your job as a career gym. Like the convict who uses the prison gym to get in shape, get as much experience as you can and as many favours as possible. do favours for people, run meetings, attend training courses, generate ideas, talk to the boss, talk to the cleaners, manage a budget, write reports, deliver presentations, make the tea. Record all of this on your CV. 4. Cull your expenses. It's probably obvious that your income must be greater than your outgoings. Bills can be avoided if you gradually eliminate your dependence on the services for which you pay. Get rid of your car and become a pedestrian. Get rid of your mobile phone by telling people to use your house phone or email instead. 5. Quit your job. This is the end of your career. Have a warm, dark beer to celebrate. 6. Give your house or apartment keys back to the landlord. Put your stuff into storage. Cancel all direct debits except for the one paying for your storage. Up until now, everything has been prologue. This is the real beginning of your escape. 7. Take your escape fund and fly to somewhere vibrant and cheap. The official best cities in which to find this combination are Zurich, Vienna, Vancouver, Geneva, Auckland, Frankfurt, Sydney, Munich, and Dusseldorf. Rent a cheap apartment there. Immigrant-heavy areas are culturally alive and financially inexpensive. They have good food, public transport, and are popular with the creative classes. 8. Invent a cottage industry. Use the rest of your time here, however much time your escape fund allows, to invent a way to ensure you'll never have to go back to work. Remind yourself of why you wanted to escape in the first place. The drudgery, the early mornings, the mindless submission, the waiting on the paychecks. Never forget the conditions from which you're escaping. 9. Put your plan in motion from your apartment or from a cozy space in a public library. When the money starts to come in, you'll have found yourself a vocation. You have escaped. Try it. The worst case scenario is that your cottage industry fails and you have to go back to the office drudgery tail between your legs. If this happens, you'll at least have enjoyed an extended vacation, lived abroad, tried and failed at entrepreneurship. This is better than what you'd have been doing otherwise. You'll have some interesting items to put on your CV and some great stories for the pub. Best of all, there's nothing to stop you from trying the whole thing again.
That was a sample of Robert Ringham's essay From Business Plan to Escape Plan, the full version of which you can read in the latest Idler magazine titled Mind Your Business. Well, we all know what's coming up now. Well, some of us do. Every week, we ask someone to create an eyebrow-raising, bizarre minute of sound for us. It's a good chance to enjoy a slice of someone's imagination. And rather than just asking our studio guests to come up with something interesting for us, we've also started asking our team of reporters around the world to see what they can do. First up is Miles Esty, who sent some sounds in from Mexico. Those are the sounds of Mexico City. In a minute, including organ players, Zapatista hymns, a pirated CD seller, and a garbage donkey. So that's just about all we have time for this week on culture. Next week, we'll be wondering what will be on our cinema screens this year and next as we assess how Sundance Film Festival went down. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbur. My studio producer was Holly Fisher. And my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. Time for one final song this week from our album of the week, Turny On by We Have Band. This is Where Are Your People? Thanks for tuning in. Here in the cold with the breeze, we're asking for you out in the heat of the desert. They're calling for you down where it's crowded and wet. They're searching for you still in the dead of the night. Here's so all we're asking, there are some things that you still evading questions, there are some things that you still go round in circles, still we need someone's mind.